All right, guys, answer me this. Tough or bluff? Threatening to punish kids for lying works in that it reduces lying behaviors. It's kind of a weirdly phrased phrase, so let me just repeat
it. I would say
it.
Bluff.
Threatening to punish kids for lying works in that it reduces lying behaviors. What do you think? Tough or bluff?
Bluff.
Okay, why?
Because...
Are you lying right now?
We'll punish you.
I have no idea. I don't know anything about children. I see them in the streets. I run away.
I think you're onto something, though. I'm going to go bluff, too, because, hey, if you lie, you'll get spanked. Well, then I'll make sure not to tell you. Like, I'll make sure to lie really well, basically. Yeah. I don't want to get caught now.
Yeah, it's bluff. Berto, you're right. According to a study with 372, well, the reasons, you're both right, but Berto's reasons are right. According to a study with 372 children ages 4 to 8, the researchers found that children were more likely to lie if they were afraid of being punished.
Yeah.
So if you tell children, if you lie, I'm really going to punish you, the chance of them lying actually goes up.
Louis C.K. has a great bit about that. It's just like lying is so useful. Like, it just works too well when you're a kid. You can just get out of things.
It's true. And that's, I think, something adults forget is that a lot of lies as children you get away with. And there's a lot of reasons to lie as children. Well, I'm not lying when I say welcome to the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a professor and I'm a licensed therapist.
I'm Dr. Paulette Perhatch. And I'm not a doctor at all. I want to get my PhD just so I can make people call me a doctor, but I'm a writer, so.
There you go. That's 60% of the reason why I got my doctor.
Yeah, and my boyfriend's a nurse, so he would have to, like, he deals with, like, you know, actual sick people all day, and I'd be like, call me doctor.
Yeah.
I'm writer Paulette Perhatch and talker on this podcast sometimes because it's fun.
My name is Omid.
No, it's not.
Fine. It's Umberto. Castañeda. And I am a harumphing coach.
Yeah. Well, that's random. Okay. So same study, people. Tough or bluff. So the same study involving the 372 children ages 4 to 8 regarding lying. I'm sure it was probably a lit room. Come on. Before leaving each child alone in a room for 1 minute, the researchers told the children that there was a toy on a table behind them, but they should not look at it during their absence. So that's all true, right? So they leave a child alone in a room and they say, there's a toy behind you. Don't look at it. I'm going to leave the room. Don't look at the toy. When the researchers returned, they asked the child whether he or she had peeked at the toy. Here's the tougher bluff. Footage from a hidden camera showed that 68% of the children had peeked and 67% of the peekers lied about it. Tougher bluff.
Ooh.
Footage of the hidden camera showed that 68% of the children had peeked at the toy when they were told not to. And of those people, of those children, 67% lied that they looked at it. So I didn't look at it,
so
even
two-thirds
though.
Two-thirds right. Looked when they weren't supposed to. And two-thirds of those lied about having looked.
I'm right. Going for more kids looked because I would look. Mm-hmm. And I'm an adult child. And that a lower percentage lied about it.
Okay,
so you're going bluff.
Going bluff.
I'm going bluff. I'm saying, I'm probably with you. I'm going 80% looked, 50% of the ones that looked lied.
It's tough.
Whoa.
A third of the children, I agree with you, Paulette, only a third of the children peaked. So that means a third of the children didn't peek. That's a lot of kids that.
I thought you said 68%.
68. Yeah, or both. Sorry, two-thirds okay. peaked. So two-thirds peaked.
That, I'm no doctor, but.
But I'm pretty sure. It just seems like that's a lot of kids not peaking, which
yeah.
you know, is sort of nice to see.
It's like the Oreo
yeah.
experiment,
right.
where it's like if you peaked, probably predicts your entire life.
You're right. You're talking about a experiment where.
The delayed gratification.
The delayed gratification yeah. bit, yeah. All right, same study, tougher bluff. As their age increased, they were more likely to tell the truth. So tougher bluff, as the subjects, the participants' age increased from 4 to 8. So the 8-year-olds were more likely to tell the truth than the 4-year-olds. Tougher bluff.
God, I think bluff. I don't want to go bluff every time, but I think bluff again. I think that you get more wily as you get older. Mm.
Did you get more wily as you got older?
Oh, I'm a horrible person. Paulette isn't even my real name.
And you're not a doctor.
I escaped from prison.
Or you really are a doctor.
I really am.
That's what you're lying about.
I killed my patient as a goof and escaped jail. Anyway, what right. do you think?
So you're saying that as they aged, more looked? That's your...
No, lied about it.
More lied about it.
Yeah.
Oh.
Regardless of looking.
Oh, that's an ugly thing. I'm going to say bluff. No, man. as they aged, less lied about it.
Paulette's right. Bluff. As they wait, did you say bluff or tough?
I said bluff.
Oh, well, then you should. Oh, wait.
As they aged, less lied about it.
I'm confused. At any rate, it's bluff. As their age increased, they were more likely to lie about it.
Oh.
And more adept at maintaining their lies, just for the reason that Paulette said, yeah, you should have said tough. So
tough.
So as apparently, according to this study, it seems that as children get older, they get better at lying. They get better at being creative about lies. Mm-hmm. They get better at their delivery of the lie.
And then they start in politics, and it's just all downhill from there.
Here's the thing. Like I get the sophistication of lying, but I'm confused about the motivation. You would think I would have hoped that as they aged, they wouldn't have been so motivated to lie.
Right. That's the hope.
Yeah, it's the hope. I hope about a lot of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hasn't your soul been crushed yet?
Well, it's interesting because it makes you wonder how often children and adults lie about things. And I think our hope is that people don't lie very often. But according to this research, it seems like they might be lying frequently.
What? I get caught every single time. Like, I can't. I wish I could be a liar.
You're a bad liar.
I am a terrible liar. I just get busted.
What kind of lies do you tell?
Oh, my God. One time, my best friend, and this story embarrasses me to this day. My best friend, I'm just like a really like whatever kind of person about germs and whatever. And so I like fed the dogs out of some bowl that was like her boyfriend, who's now the like father of her child. It like was like his like eating bowl. And then they were like, where's that bowl? And I knew that they would be mad about it, so I lied. They had already seen the dogs eating out of it. Oh, I think that was the last time I like really, I don't know. I mean, there's white lies. They're useful in society. Like you don't go through the day not lying.
Right.
You know, how are you? I'm fine. Oh, no, you're dying inside.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I'm not like, you know, the movie Liar Liar, but I have to just own up to shit. So I try to be good.
Yeah.
I actually try to do that at work with the fellow Harump coaches. Every now and then someone will ask me, hey, how's it going? Right. Or hi, how's it going? But often I'll be like, well, not so great today. And then I could tell they're like, oh, I didn't really mean to ask you. But I'm like, yeah, you know, this morning I had this. And I start like going into it. And they're like slowly backing away.
Start crying.
But my thing is this. Like, if you ask me, I'm going to tell you. You know?
I wish there were in our culture like signs of like grieving like there are in other cultures, just where it's like, don't ask me how I'm doing if I'm wearing the black veil.
Oh,
like for
right.
men too, you just get to have a black veil when you don't want anyone to talk to you.
Absolutely. I wish in my mind it's a sign that we have like sticking out of our head.
A little cardboard.
and we can put lots of things on it.
Sure.
Oh,
like I have a brother that's an addict.
Yeah.
Ask me questions.
Well, it's like in the little text chat programs where you can have a little status.
Dude, I was going to say an app, dude. Umberto, you could totally make that happen. That should be an app. And like when you're at work, it's like, don't talk to me. No, because when you get close to someone, it's like geofenced. And it's like, don't talk to me.
I could see that. And you get the message on your phone. You're like, what's that?
It's like a social media.
I'm not supposed to talk to this person.
Don't talk to this person.
I could see that. But I want you to wear a placard or something.
Just
you
wear
know.
One.
Yeah.
We could
all
cardboard.
Have Teletubby signs with things that we program in to have it say.
Shirts with like emoji, like a little emoji screen.
Yeah. Oh.
And it's like, don't ask me how I am. I'll put my emoji. Don't talk to me. It's just the poop. It's like I'm smiling, but I feel like a piece of poop. Don't talk to me.
That could get confusing because people could be like,
I need to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, do you need to go to the bathroom? Or
we can work in schools. Kids won't have to raise their hands.
Potty.
I have a theory that the poop emoji is the most frequently used emoji ever.
What?
Oh,
no.
I use it every other emoji.
I just went to a flip phone, and I love it for my ADD. It's great.
I saw your flip phone. I wanted to make fun of you, but
God.
I didn't.
Well, I like abruptly am not working, and I had a work iPhone, and I was just like went to the store, and I was like, oh, my God, like I'm not working like as of today. And it was like they were like, okay, what plan? We're going to run a credit check. And I was just like, how much is that flip phone? And they're like, $15. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to buy myself some time. And I totally love it. I was one of the zombies at the parties on Facebook, and so it's great.
Oh, wow. So you've scaled back.
It just makes you, because you're sitting around, and you can't be like, you can't know what your email is, and I'm just like a...
One second. Okay, what?
Put your phone down.
Okay, another tougher bluff for you. 15% of U.S. children have experienced trauma. Tougher bluff. 15% of U.S. children, according to research, has experienced emotional trauma.
Ugh.
Tougher bluff. What do you think?
I'm just going to crawl under my seat and cry. Emotional trauma?
Yeah.
Is there a clinical term for that?
Yes, like an event where you thought you might die or witnessing sexual abuse or having it happen to you.
This is really interesting because I think I'm always wondering, like, I had a totally like fine childhood. I was just like actually writing about how everyone wonders about their own childhood, and I didn't have anything that would be really trauma as a young person, you know, but it's like, where did your childhood rank in the overall scheme of things? Like, you think everyone else is the Brady Bunch, but then you remember that like these terrible things happen. And God, why do I want to say that I think it's more? Isn't that terrible?
Is that what you think?
Well, I used to be a reporter, so it really skews your brain, because all I heard about was terrible things happening to children.
Yeah.
I am going to try to be more positive and just say tough, but okay. I think it's only that much.
Okay.
I'm going to say bluff 30%.
Ugh.
It's bluff 48%.
Oh, God.
Researchers examined data from more than 95,000 children from birth to age 17 and found that 48% had encountered at least one of the 9 types of adverse experiences, including physical or emotional abuse or neglect, deprivation, substance abuse problems, and exposure to violence.
Oh, my God. See, this is why I'm on this podcast, because I'm totally going to put that in my story. That's...
You're like, no one suffers.
Yeah, well...
1%.
No, it's like just appreciating. I feel like, and I'd love to chat with you guys more about this, actually, like, why are we evolved to remember only the bad things? I think it's for survival. Like, your brain just catalogs it. Like, when you're just chilling out, your brain's like, all right, everything's fine. When something bad happens and you feel in danger, you're like, remember this. So I think...
I don't...
Go ahead.
That's not quite right, is it?
It is.
That doesn't seem right at all.
What do you mean?
It's just memorable moments, not necessarily good or
but
bad.
But why are they memorable? Why does your brain click on and say, okay, now remember this?
Different reasons, right? Like,
well, they've studied this, and when we experience a particular stimulus that creates a chain reaction in our body and in our brain and our neurochemicals and this sort of thing and our hormones, our brain has this mechanism, and I'm not a neuroscientist, so I'm going to butcher it, but the memory circuits in the brain become activated in a way that it records minutiae. It records in it, and people will have a sense that time is slowing down. Like when you got in the car wreck, you might have felt as though time was slowing down. And I think that, if I remember right, that's because the brain is in a different state and it's trying to record every single frame that's occurring. And it has an adaptive benefit, because if a saber-toothed tiger jumps out of a particular tree in a particular way and something happened just before that, like there was a particular sound that the tiger made, then you want to record all that data, because the next time that happens, you want to know what that is. You don't want to be surprised again. So that's why the brain does
it. So can I ask a question?
Sure.
So how can we be more fair in our relationships when all we remember is the bad stuff that someone did to us, you know?
That's a little different.
I still don't
believe it's all bad. It's just surprising.
I think that it is... Right. It's not all.
It's a little different what you're talking about in terms of non-traumatic negative experiences.
Yeah.
So if you had a fight with your, you know, partner, then why is it do we remember that? Well, there's differences. Some people actually remember those things a lot and some people don't.
Yeah.
But it's a similar idea or speculation about why we would evolve to remember negative things. Again, is to try to avoid them.
Like clearly I'm only one data point, but I have way many more memories that are, I wouldn't qualify as bad, but they are salient. Like, I remember when I was learning how to read, I remember this moment with my grandma looking at the little booklet. Like, that's important, right? I remember when I found out my grandpa had gotten rid of the red car and replaced it with a green car, and I saw that in the letter from my grandma. I remember that, right? Like, those aren't bad. It's just salient, surprising. You know, it's that kind of thing. And there's the bad ones, too.
And then there's some stuff where you're like, that is the most... that's the dumbest detail of my childhood that, like, ever. Like, why is that in my brain?
I have this one memory that pops into my head, and it just did as you said that. Mm-hmm. It's this random memory of being at Lake Chelan, actually, I think in my 20s, and I'm sitting at a particular restaurant at a particular table, and I can remember the way the candle looks, but there was nothing special about that moment. But for whatever reason, over the years, it just keeps popping into my head. It's the strangest thing. Do you have a memory like that where you're like, why do I keep why does that keep popping up? It has nothing to do with anything, and my brain is just focused on this moment.
It's weird. We're too weird. I can't deal with life sometimes, a lot of times.
I wrote a paper once about how so we think, you know, our personality is based on the last, like, I'm 40. So, oh, well, my personality is based on my last 40 years of experience. And in a way it is, and in a way it isn't, because if you actually, if I went to catalog, in fact, I'll probably do this as an experiment. If I actually catalog all the things I actually can remember, and I know that I can maybe remember more if I do certain things and stuff, but if I did that, it's not 40 years worth of memories.
No.
It's actually very sparse in the end.
But then there's a woman who remembers every single moment of her entire life.
Yeah.
And she says, so it's capable, it's possible in our brains, which is like crazy.
How does she do anything else?
She just says it's like overwhelming that she
Gotta
hates
be.
It.
Well, yeah, I don't know if you heard the same podcast or news story, but essentially for some people, their memories don't fade. And so there's a pro and a con to that. One is they remember what they were wearing on February 3rd of 1996. So that's interesting, and it's a
pink
shorts, a neat party trick. But on the other hand, everything that bad that has happened to you, you remember like it was yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So when your cat died, or when your mom died, or when you got broken up with in the third grade, you remember it as if it was yesterday. And there's an adaptive function of forgetting that kind of stuff so that you it doesn't hurt you anymore. You know, time heals, as they say.
Ugh.
I wonder what things those brains aren't able to do instead of storing all that information, you know, or because of storing all that.
I have a tough or bluff that's kind of a riff off that last one.
Cool.
If you'd like to hear it. Tough or bluff. People who are children of Holocaust survivors have a measurable physiological difference than most other people.
Measurable physiological difference.
I hope that I used all those words correctly.
Probably.
I need a dictionary.
I mean, I will go tough. I'll say tough because they might actually all have some sort of preconditioned higher blood pressure or something like that.
Kirk, are you Googling?
Didn't you want me to?
Well, you have to answer first.
I think it's tough. It depends on what we mean by physiological difference, but when you affect an entire population of people or I should say, when someone's been traumatized in the way that you would get traumatized when you are in a concentration camp where lots of people are dying, and then you have children, the chance that those children will have something different about them is I would say, reasonable.
It's tough. They have altered levels of cortisol, according to Scientific American.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Well, you don't even need me to look this. I thought you wanted me to Google this one.
I know I did. Afterwards, you had to guess first.
I didn't find it anyway. But right. So stress hormone. So now we don't know the cause. We just have a correlation. We have a group
of people.
You're
so balanced. You're always trying to be so fair. I just want to run and just be like, it's true.
Well, it's true. The data is true. But what does it mean? Does it mean that this it could even mean that the people with higher cortisol levels survived more in these camps because they were more alerted to the difficulties and therefore managed to stave off the things that
that's an interesting hypothesis.
Would kill them. Yeah. And then genetically speaking, they have this difference in their genetic code, and they pass it on to their children. So it would be a selected for trait. Or
remind me what cortisol.
Stress hormone.
Okay.
You know, I didn't I'm interested. Maybe next time we can talk about this if you want to read up on it, because I didn't quite understand. There were some things that the scientists had expected the opposite of what actually happened, like if it were higher or lower. But I would need to read it twice for sure.
Okay. Yeah. Another possibility is that when you have been traumatized, your parenting is affected. And when you're raising your children, having been traumatized yourself, you're going to be more anxious, you're going to be more reactive, mm-hmm. and you might have some difficulties with parenting that could lead to all of those children, on average, having more stress in their life and therefore higher levels of cortisol.
Here's a wacky hypothesis. Those children or those people grew up hearing the stories, and now they're under examination and being compared to others, and that raises their stress because they maybe not consciously, but the subconscious, they're like, that's what they were telling me. They would. Right.
That's so true. Yeah, that is so true.
Right.
It's a little out there.
So,
by
it's
the way, I got a wacky hypothesis would be a great pickup line if you ever need that.
Oh, nice.
Hey, what would you need to follow it up with?
I got a wacky hypothesis. Oh, just so many things. It could be the your mama's joke of pickup
Excuse
lines.
Excuse me. I've got a wacky hypothesis.
No, you
got
to say it with the voice you said it in.
Okay.
I got a wacky hypothesis.
I can't think of anything. Oh, it's like then you just fall into one of the cheesy ones, right? Like, excuse me, I got a wacky hypothesis. I can't even say it.
Oh, wacky hypothesis.
Do you have a little Asian in you?
No, it's got to be better than that. Because you're like,
I have a wacky hypothesis.
Your father, what is the usual one? Is your father an angel or what's the deal?
Is your father an angel?
You're terrible
you
at
fell
this.
Fell down from earth and
you're terrible
landed on your wings. How does it go?
Oh my God, I don't know.
Is your father a wing maker for angels? Because you...
Isn't it something like because you fell, didn't you fall from
nothing
heaven?
Like a guy you bringing your father and like mentioning your father and picking you up.
Is your grandpa in the business of angel making?
Do you guys follow Humans of New York?
No.
There was such a good one today. Oh my God, it's such a good, I guess, I don't know if I just follow it on Facebook, so I see it on Facebook, but it's just this photographer who goes around taking really humanizing photos of people in New York City, just them. And you can kind of see the chaos all around, but it's really focused on them. And he just tells like a little bit of their story. And it's amazing. Mm. It's so cool. And he got a grant to go around the world too. He was in Africa for a little while. And it's just, I don't know. There's something about it that's so simple, but it's so great. So there was one about a girl who went to New York City to meet up with a guy that she met on Craigslist. And it was a little graphic. I don't know how much I can talk about.
What do you mean? Did they hook up or?
So I'll tell you and you can just cut it out if you want to. So she said
people want to know what happened.
She
I know.
Was like, she was really young. She was like 18 and it was just a picture like of her boots first. And he was like.
Boots spelled B-O-O-B-S.
Boots. Boot. A boot. She would wear.
She's flashing her boots at you right now.
Yes.
So she said, I'm here to meet a guy who's like 55. We met on a BDSM website.
Oh.
Yeah.
How old was she?
She was like 18. She was really young.
Is a BDSM a boot designer?
So this is a 50 Shades of Grey thing.
This is a 50. I haven't read the book. I've inferred a lot. But I think as a writer, I can't read the book.
Probably not. It'll taint you.
Sorry. So then she was like, her parents were like super Christian. And she said one time they got mad at her at church for leaning against her friend. And they said that she looked like she was acting like a lesbian and that she used to tie her toys up and beat them when she was little. And her parents just thought it was funny. And then she like turned out to be like really into BDSM.
That's funny.
It was crazy. So you get this like really crazy story and these beautiful photographs and. I think it's like a Beatles song where you learn the Beatles and their songs are so simple. Mm. You're like, that's it. Mm. Like, it doesn't take much to play them, but they're amazing. And sometimes the best art is like so simple. Mm. It's just a guy going around New York, taking pictures of people and like telling their story. It's
right.
crazy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it.
Cool. All right. Do you have a tough for bluff there, Birdo? I do.
I've got a wacky.
I have another
hypothesis.
One that has the word physiological.
Okay. What? Let's do yours.
So tough or bluff, reading can cause a physiological change in your body.
That seems plausible. The act of sitting still probably has a change, but also the mental activity of concentrating on something and also the potential escape into another world probably does something to her body. So I'll say tough.
I mean, I can see a billion ways in which that has to be tough. If nothing else, your eyesight absolutely changes based on the amount you read. And so tough.
It is actually tough, and it is that it releases dopamine in your brain when you like a story, like when you're reading fiction.
That's dope.
Isn't that crazy?
It is. All right, tough or bluff. While completing work-related computer tasks, workers prefer the following in order of preference, okay? So walking Because they developed a walking computer, you know, where you can walk. So walking is best. Seated or standing are in the middle. So, you know, they have those standing desks and the seated desks, obviously. And cycling is the worst. So they did an experiment on people and they said, we want you to stand at your desk. We want you to sit at your desk. We want you to cycle at your desk. And we want you to walk at your desk. And which is the best in terms of a worker preference.
Preference or them being productive? Or-
while completing work-related computer task, workers prefer the following in order of preference. Walking is best, then seating and standing are in the middle, and cycling is the worst. Regarding the following domains, boredom, task, satisfaction, stress, arousal, and performance. Tough or bluff, what do you think?
Which was, sorry, read again the preferences.
Arousal? Did you say arousal?
Arousal, yeah. Like, not
what are they working on?
Not being tired.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So boredom, task, satisfaction, stress, arousal, and performance.
But like, those are the categories. But no. Is the tougher bluff around?
The tougher bluff is around the order of walking, seated, and standing, and cycling.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to hear again, that order.
Oh, walking, seated, and standing are in the middle. They're the same, and cycling is the worst.
Okay, got it.
This is the difference between scientists and writers. No writers would put arousal, because they're just like, yeah. It's not the right word. But a scientist is like, it is technically arousal. I am going to write arousal.
And apparently people use taint in one particular way now. With Paulette's reaction when I said taint. I have two definitions of taint. One is downstairs and one is to make something dirty.
I'm not a normal person.
I've never seen you so red in my life.
I'm so red right now. I can feel it. This is how I joke. I wish I were born a guy because I love really dirty jokes. And it's so hard as a girl because I'm talking to the girls and I have to make the dirtiest joke I can think of. Like my friends and I in college, it was like, who can make the dirtiest jokes? And all the guys would be going back and forth. And then I would just be like the only girl in there, you know, just like saying the worst things. So now that's where my brain goes. I have changed my own brain.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, it's a skill.
It's a skill.
Yeah. So I'm tough really... bluff. What do you think? Walking, seated, or standing, and cycling?
I would say seated and standing.
Do you think that's the right order with walking at the best, seating and standing in the middle, and cycling at the worst?
Yes.
Tough. Okay.
Walking, really? I'm going to go bluff. It's standing, then... Can I separate them or no?
Yeah.
Okay, standing is first, then walking, then sitting, then cycling.
What do you think?
That's what I'm saying.
Is that what you would like?
Yeah.
That's what you would like? So you think standing is the best?
I don't think I can work while cycling. That one's out. That's just me.
Okay.
I think standing still without walking is, in fact, what I do mostly at the harumph.com.
Oh, really? You have a standing desk?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I mostly just stand. And I like it. It does get tiring, so I need to sit down sometimes. But overall, I feel better. And walking might be too much. And sitting is bad.
Well, it's tough. Walking, according to these participants, is the best, which sounds not good. Seating and standing were the same in the middle.
Really?
So you could sit or stand, and they were the same. And then cycling was the worst, which makes total sense to me. I can't imagine trying to cycle while doing
probably that. Probably lowest for arousal.
No, I mean, I have never tried it.
And cycling does affect your taint, by the way.
It taints you as a rider.
When I used to bike a lot, before my friend broke his back and I decided never to bike again because I never wore a helmet and I thought, I'm next. If he broke his back, I'm next. My taint would go numb.
I just finished reading The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and it said apostrophe taint for it ain't. And every time I just be alone, I'd just be like, I can't not do it. It's a terrible affliction. I've stopped parties before where I'm like a friend of a friend. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm around regular people. That's why I have to live on Capitol Hill.
Well, I'm going to start saying it's no longer tough or bluff. It's taint true and tis true. Tis true and taint true. All right, Brady, you got one?
Taint true. Almost.
You do like dirty jokes, don't you?
Oh, my God. I love it so much.
How's the stand-up coming anyway? Have you done it?
Oh, I just did it the other night, and I wasn't as scared as my first time. And I was like, oh, okay, like I've done this before. So then I procrastinated, and then I didn't practice as many times as I practiced the time before, so it just went okay. It wasn't terrible, but...
Tell us one of your jokes.
Oh, God.
Well...
You shouldn't do that to a comedian, right?
Why not?
Unless you have
it
one.
It is true that you should not do that to a comedian. I've read.
Why not?
Because it's very. It's like,
well, Berto, sing a song.
Okay, this is a song. I love it.
You know what I mean?
What?
You can't represent your craft.
Yeah, there's a whole.
I've had people do that. Actually, Paul David, who's been on the podcast before, my mentor.
Yeah.
When I told him I was a singer like 15 years ago, he's like, oh, sing a song. And because he was kind of my boss, I felt like I had to. So I'm like, okay. And I just sang one of my songs. And it was the dumbest thing. And that moment has been totally encoded into my brain because traumatic for me.
Isn't it funny how we won't just be like, no.
Yeah.
We won't just be like, that makes me uncomfortable.
No, I'm not going to sing a song for you. That's
We just do it. Terrible.
Yeah. So anyway, sell one of your jokes, monkey.
Jeez, I'm out of here.
Something involving taint, hopefully.
I don't have any of those. So basically, that's not going to be as funny. Yeah, I mean, you kind of design what's funny because sometimes things are visual.
Yeah. And it has to be like in the moment and I don't know.
Yeah, it's like a whole thing.
Yeah.
So I hope this is a funny one. I joked about just being like huge. Like I'm the height of the average man. And how there's just a lot of female experiences that happen to involve someone picking you up. Like, you're just like, you know, you like when you're like little.
That's already funny.
You're like watching MTV. You're like, I'm going to be the girl on my boyfriend's shoulders at the music festival, just dancing in a bikini top. And then you're like, have to stand in the back so everyone else can see. And you're just like wearing a t-shirt, eating a hot dog. And you can see that girl up front.
I would laugh at this. This is entertaining. Oh, yeah. I want to go to your shows.
I prefer people just say I would laugh at this rather than laugh. That's what I'm going for.
Well, no, I'm laughing, and if I were there, I would laugh at it.
Okay, that would be something that I would laugh at if I heard it. If I heard that, I might laugh.
Can I throw a shout out for this comedy program?
Comedy Womb.
Not selfishly, but I just think that it's a really great place.
Yeah.
And Danielle. K.L. Gregorio, I think is her name, and she's really fun, and she just runs this room that's like a hate-free room.
Where See, that's funny.
It's true.
I would laugh at that.
He's trying to make a joke back. just back away. And okay. Keep going.
So I just think it's a really great thing to go to in Seattle, and open mics can be terrifying because there's nothing worse than standing like 5 feet away from someone who isn't as good as they think they are and is like giving it their all but still terrible, and you're just like, oh god, like I want to root for you, but like you're not ready like to bring this out in public.
Yeah.
And no one wants that to happen. Everyone's been there when it's happened, you know, and some of us, I've like definitely probably been that person just like, I'm gonna go to open mic night, and it's like, no, not yet.
Yeah,
like that needs to stay in your journal for a long time.
Well, it's such a craft, it's such a skill.
Yeah,
and you never know what's gonna go over well. I mean, so, even the greats have to practice their routines, you know what I mean?
And everyone's like, bombing is totally fine, but so many people there are so funny, and like I was so pleasantly surprised. I'm like, this is really fun, and my friends just really like to go because everyone's really funny. So
Comedy Womb at Rendezvous, right?
At the Rendezvous downstairs at 7 and 9 on Tuesdays.
Yeah, after you told me about it a couple months ago, I was at the Rendezvous and I took a picture of their flyer and texted it to you, and then you texted me back, why are you sending this to me? And I was like,
and I
was like, because yesterday we were talking about Comedy Womb, and you're like, oh, okay.
I think you're putting a lot of tone on my text. Are you PMSing? It's a full moon.
I want to go do comedy, man. I would be so funny. I'd be like,
do it.
So you know when you're like brushing your teeth in the morning and you get toothpaste everywhere on your face and like it goes on the counter?
So you're kind of going for like what do they call it? What was it? Lodka?
Well, I'm not done with a joke.
Oh.
Oh.
And then like you try to clean it up, but it's everywhere. And so, yeah.
See, that's what I'm saying. That's concept humor. Like the guy from Taxi. What's his name?
Well, I just
that was supposed to be a really funny joke. I
wanted my writing to be funnier.
If you did that for a half an hour, by the middle, people would actually start laughing. Like
or killing me.
Yeah.
I just wanted my writing to be funnier because I'm like, my writing isn't as funny as I want it to be. So I got this book, The Comedy Bible, and it says that even if you just want to write funny, you have to do stand up. But I was kind of like, oh, I kind of love it because I used to watch stand up all the time when I was little. Inappropriately. Like I watched, who is it? Eddie Murphy's Delirious at my like 13th birthday party. Sorry, everyone else's mom who was there. I was like, this is a very well supervised birthday party.
See, I would laugh at you. I would.
Good.
Yeah, I remember seeing Delirious when it came out when I was like 10 years old, and my god,
it's so bad.
I memorized that thing at the age of 11.
Oh yeah, we loved it.
Like, I
so hilarious.
Right. I could recite to you right now the entirety of Delirious.
Let's just make that the rest of the thing. There's so much.
Lemonade.
There's stuff that's not appropriate. You're just like, oh, God. You're like, Eddie Murphy is like a 1980s bad person.
Yeah. Oh, he was awesome.
All the stuff about, like,
so good.
Get AIDS and stuff. You're like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, it was.
Soon you're
PC.
Just going to put it in and then.
Yeah. Yes. It was not PC. That is for sure.
Oh, it was not PC.
But it's not as bad as some
Andrew Dice
today.
Clay. It's not as bad
well.
As.
Oh, he makes me so uncomfortable. I'm like, ugh.
Yeah. Hey, I got a tougher bluff.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, wait, what?
This isn't a joke. Oh. Am I a joke to you? Hmm. The term political psychology was first introduced by ethnologist Adolf Bastian.
Oh, God.
In his book Man in History in 1930. Tough or bluff?
Tough.
Bluff.
Why?
Because there are too many facts in there. You're like my old history teacher who would put like, write a 100-word sentence with like a million facts in it. It's like true or false. You're just like.
It's a good guide.
Out of like the chances of all those facts, false.
But that's very. Taint. Very good. But there is something that you might have wondered about is, did the term political psychology really only come out in 1930? So it was bluff. It was in 1860. It's a way before 1930.
Interesting.
That was.
Okay, tough or bluff. Attending religious services with a parent results in greater psychological well-being for children.
Oh, God.
Attending religious services with a parent results in greater psychological well-being for the children. Tough or bluff, what do you think?
Okay. Oh, God, you're really
in the long term or in the short term?
I think it's a long, like, consistent over time. So, like, consistent well-being, not just, you know, for 5 minutes.
Yeah. I think it does because religion is a way to communicate morals. So I went to church through middle school, and I still feel like, you know, that it's not the way I am anymore. I'd probably classify myself as agnostic. I'm just like, we can't even see all the colors. We don't know what's going on. So I'm an agnostic right now. But
did you have increased well-being back then because of that?
I think I've had overall increased well-being because it kind of delayed being bad a few years. Mm. I don't know. It's hard to tell how bad I was. You know, you're like,
right.
Some kids are super square, but some kids are really like going off a cliff.
Right.
So we were drinky, but I think mostly
so you didn't
good.
Start murdering until you were 17.
I didn't start murdering. I started stabbing about 19.
Okay. So that's the
but
gateway.
I did,
that's
you
the
know,
gateway. Stabbing's the gateway.
I swore to remain a virgin until I was married in front of all.
Speaking of stabbing.
It involved jewelry.
That's so, taint right.
I taint right.
Can you remind me which one's tough, which one's bluff?
Attending religious services.
Oh, yeah. That's right. I am going to go bluff, darn you.
It's tough. Scientists examined data from about 6,000 adolescents over age 15 and found that even though attending services with parents didn't always reflect a youth's own religious beliefs, it was associated with adolescents feeling greater connectedness to both their parents and the larger religious community.
I think it creates community. I think that's the biggest problem in, like, I know in my life, I always say, like, I miss church. Like, I wish there was a place where I could go once a week with people who really believed what I believe. And, like, sometimes that's, like, that's what concerts are now. Mm-hmm. You're like, I go out on Saturday night, I see other artists, I see art, and I'm just like part of the community in Seattle.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a client who was isolating a lot in middle school, early high school, and he, you know, his parents were very concerned that he was just staying in his room all the time and wasn't socializing at all and seemed maybe depressed. And the church harangued him into going to youth group or youth activities with the church. And he was totally against it at first, but eventually gave in and then loved it and then started to thrive. And he was out of the room and he was enjoying life. And he wasn't particularly religious, but he liked the community, as you're saying.
So I wish there was. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Why was he freezing himself?
This is a pun on something I said.
Well, what happens is I have a friend who has a 4-year-old daughter. And she loves the movie Frozen. And so he posted a video of her like talking about how she wants to isolate her hands so that she can freeze things.
Isolate.
Because in the song, it's a kingdom of isolation. And so she thinks it's isolation.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I'm being the 4-year-old.
I see.
I've never heard the Frozen song.
What?
I know.
Let it go. Let it go.
Hold me back anymore.
Let it go. Da, da, da.
Paulette furrows her brow and looks confused and scared.
What?
Paulette furrows her brow and looks confused and scared.
Not a footprint to be seen. A kingdom of isolation.
At Birdo's 40th birthday party, some children karaoke'd it.
Oh, man.
That's true.
I totally want this thing I saw on Shark Tank. I'm trying to start a business, so I'm obsessed with Shark Tank right now.
Of course.
And
The
show where basically people take their business ideas and go to these four like gazillionaires and say like, will you give me money for this much of my business? And they like tear them apart or like offer them a bunch of money. But it's very scary and intense.
Yeah.
So I really like that show. And there was this product on there that's karaoke that makes your voice sound good. It was the guys who invented Guitar Hero. And the guy's like, I suck at singing. And he starts singing and it sucks. And then he sings into this machine. And it's like amazing. And I'm like, that is such a good idea because I love karaoke. I am a terrible singer. And then you feel bad for everyone. You're like, I'm having fun, but I'm sorry you have to hear this. So I have to go for like rapping or just yelling.
But that's part of the fun.
No, it's terrible. I would much rather.
What's your go-to song?
I love Regulators. I also love Electric Feel.
Oh,
GMT.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I like Do You Realize?
Ba-na-na-na-bump.
He's ruining karaoke.
No, he's making it so much better.
I would have torn him apart if I was in that Shark Tank. Land Shark. I would have been like, listen, sir, karaoke is plenty popular, and it's because you want to hear the good and the bad.
Yeah.
No.
If you vanilla-size the whole thing, it's not interesting.
I am the least culturally sensitive to the way that Paraguayans sing karaoke. We were in Paraguay when I was living down there, and a few of my friends and I went to this karaoke bar, and they just sat at the tables and sang sad love songs. I'm like, you just get the microphone. And we were just like being extremely ethnocentric. We're like, this is not how karaoke works. Like, you get up on stage and you sing a loud song and you embarrass yourself.
Yeah. You do it like the Americans because they invented karaoke.
Yeah, right. So like, I know it was just, I should be so much more culturally sensitive about it. But we're just like, we want you guys to experience how awesome it can be. You're being sad.
Did you like get him to stand up on the table?
No. Like,
you got to sing better songs, you know, like Let It Go and other songs.
Like so we would all sign up and like they would get a song and they would just be at their table, like sitting in a booth, just like, mi corazoncito te extraño mucho, da, da, da. And then we would like, then it would be our turn. We'd get up on stage and we'd just be like screaming.
Oh, we're halfway there.
Totally.
Okay, yeah. So here's
and
how.
And then they would get it back. It was terrible.
Here's how your story would have gone if this guy's invention ever sees the light of day. So we were at this karaoke thing. And it was fine. And everyone just sang.
No, they would have sang well, sad
Next story.
Songs, and we would have
Next
sang awesome
story.
Songs well.
But it's like, you know what? I went to the races. I went to the horse races. It was great. All the horses took off at the same time and came in at the same time.
No.
It was awesome.
You're inaccurate. No, it's a varied experience.
You're a communist. He is a communist.
I wish
communist.
I had a recording. Of that, I guess I do.
Are you recording?
I guess
Wait,
I had
did
a.
Re- you forget to hear
I guess I had a recording of that little bit of you saying that is inaccurate, Roberto.
You've been faking this whole time. You have schizophrenia.
There is no podcast.
There is no podcast.
Soon you'll realize it is you that bends.
The Matrix 5. There is no podcast.
Berto, you can take the blue mic or the red mic.
What would that be?
I've got a wacky theory. Oh, no, hypothesis.
Hey, I've got a... Hey, lady. Oh, excuse me, ma'am. I've got a wacky hypothesis for you.
I got a tougher wacky bluff. Sigmund Freud. Okay. The text Totem and Taboo and Group Psychology and the Analysis of the Ego by Sigmund Freud link psychoanalysis with politics. Tougher bluff.
Read the title again.
What?
His text Totem and Taboo and Group Psychology and the Analysis of the Ego link psychoanalysis with politics.
Your tougher bluffs require a PowerPoint presentation. I need to see this in writing.
Two books by Sigmund Freud.
Okay.
In 1913 and 1921.
The last one,
psychoanalysis,
was ridiculous because there's no way either one of us would have any idea, particularly given the way you worded it. This one, I actually have a little bit of idea about, but...
But if you do on this one, you should have known that the term didn't come in that...
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
It's not a popular thing, political psychology. That's not a popular. I know you would think it would be, but it's not a popular term.
Oh.
Yeah. You wouldn't
know
that.
But I mean, Freud was what year? 1956.
Yeah. You understand the entirety of history is not taught to people. In fact, the fact that I even know this is because the fact that I know anything about this thing is because I've just made it my mission in life to know about
Freud. So I should have said 1960. That would have been easier.
It's such an obscure field that you're talking about that. But anyway, but you wouldn't know that, so whatever. I'm going to say bluff that it was a different book, and if it was a different book, and I think you're actually listing two books of his.
Yeah, both of those books link psychoanalysis with politics. That's the topic.
Oh, Totem and Taboo, maybe. But there is another publication by Freud that is slipping my mind right now that I think has more to do with politics, but anyway.
I don't,
just guess.
I'm not up on my 30s
and most
Freud.
Most of the ones we do here are guessing.
I guess bluff.
All right.
Taint.
It's tough. That's what Wikipedia says.
Now I'm too
so
sad. Now I'm sad.
I've not read either of those books, but it says so on the interwebs.
Can we Instagram your cat?
I know. I love it when she does upside down.
This
head.
Is when I have a flip phone and I can't take a picture of it and I just have to...
You just have to look at it and
look at it and experience it. It's so uncomfortable. No one will ever know how cute your cat looks right now. Aww. So it has its paws just curled up under its little chinny chin chin, and it's just sleeping. And it looks cute.
Well, when she wants to be cute, she does an upside down head. It's hard to describe, but
it's like old timey radio. You have to picture it. Use your imagination.
Yeah. Okay. Tougher bluff. U.S. teens who have been prescribed anxiety or sleep medications are 2 times more likely to abuse those drugs than teens who have never received a prescription.
Yes. Jesus.
So U.S. teens who have been prescribed anxiety or sleep medications are 2 times more likely to abuse those drugs than teens who have never received a prescription for those drugs. Tougher bluff.
Well, I think anxiety makes people more likely to abuse drugs.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. Including alcohol.
Yeah. Oh, so I would say that it's, I would say it's tough.
Okay. Have you ever taken an anti-anxiety medication or sleep medication?
Yeah, I want to talk about this on a podcast. And yes.
You don't have to.
No, I am your typical anxious writer. It's terrible. And
Have you taken Xanax or Valium?
No. I took like Wellbutrin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did it help?
I can't tell if I'm comfortable talking about this or not. It's so like hard to admit it. And I think I read this article today where this chick was talking about her anxiety and actually posted it on Facebook today. And I was like, oh, I needed this today. Anxiety sucks. And then I was like, oh God, should I have said that? Yeah, like, you have anxiety about your anxiety, which is awesome.
It is the most prevalent area of, shall we call it, mental illness or mental conditions?
Yeah.
Something like a third of Americans will have a full-blown anxiety disorder.
So this is my question. Like,
at some point in their life.
How can we call it an illness if a third of people have it? It just seems more like a trait.
Well, but you can have a huge number of people die from influenza, and that's still an illness, right?
Yeah, it just depends on how we want to define illness.
But influenza is a disease, and anxiety is something that is naturally born in the human being.
Well, influenza is an infection. I mean, if you've been infected, the disease can manifest from the infection. But it all just depends on our cultural definition of illness.
Well, yeah, because like one could say, like, you know, our stomach has tons of bacteria in it. So what's one more bacteria? We're still the same organism. Yeah. It happens to be one seizes our life, the other one does. You know, so it's like.
Yeah.
But anyways, I digress. I'm gonna say tough.
It's bluff. They're 12 times more likely.
12
to
abuse. Oh my
times?
God.
Yeah.
12 times.
Looking at data over 3 years from more than 2,700 high school and middle school students, researchers found that almost 9% of the students had been prescribed a potentially addictive benzodiazepine for treating anxiety or sleep problems at some point in their life, like Xanax or Valium. Students who were prescribed anti-anxiety medications were 12 times more likely to use someone else's anti-anxiety medication and abusing it.
Oh, God.
Oh, wow.
So basically what we have here is socially sanctioned, medically sanctioned pushing of highly addictive drugs to children without much thought about how it'll affect them regarding their propensity to start abusing substances.
See, but sorry.
No, could you go ahead?
I am like trying everything to not be on drugs anymore because when I joined Peace Corps, they said you can't be on anti-anxiety medication. And that turned out to not be true.
Yeah, why would that be true?
I don't know, because they take care of your medical. There's just like a lot of information. So I can see how something like that would, you know, you could hear wrong for sure. I just heard wrong. And so I was like, oh my God, all right. I got to live without like anxiety medication. And so I started looking into like, oh my God, it's so funny. Like my mom was like, you should try the Lucinda Bassett thing that you see on the infomercials. And I was like, all right, like, let's do it. All right.
What's that thing?
It's like the cheesiest like anti-anxiety thing, but like I love her. Like, it's sweet. It's really like, sweet.
Is it medication or is it a behavioral
thing? No, it's a whole like folder full of CDs and there's a booklet and So there's this meditation on it about you're going through and you're going down and then you see a waterfall. And
that sounds relaxing.
One of my best friends had anxiety at the time. And so that was like our thing where we could talk about our anxiety together. And when one of us started freaking out, the other one would be like, you need to take it to the waterfall right now. So then that kind of opened my mind up to like the idea that you don't have to listen to your thoughts. Like not all your thoughts are accurate. And then there's like meditation and I mean, I'm like bring on everything. I do yoga. I do meditation. Like I'm like, I try to do everything I can to not be anxious, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. There's a lot of things that one can do besides medication. I don't want to dog on medication. I think it's a fine thing. I recommend it to my clients. But in terms of prescribing it to children, 9% of these children had been prescribed a potentially addictive benzodiazepine.
Do you think teenagers are children? What do you think?
Well, again, it's just how we define illness or children or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
But they could solve this easily, right? Just prescribe it to everyone.
Right.
And then no one would be 12 times more likely.
That's right, because they'll all be addicted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. It's a good solution. I like your thinking.
It's a wacky hypothesis.
I'm sure the drug companies would love that. This is the same study for Tougher Bluff. Researchers found that white students were twice as likely as black students to use the medications without a prescription.
Which ones?
So researchers found that white students were twice as likely as black students to use the medications without a prescription. So in other words, the white students were more likely to abuse the drug than black students after being prescribed it. Tougher Bluff.
I think that's probably true.
How come?
Well, I think, you know, it's definitely something that we have to talk about, that it's been shown that white kids and black kids use drugs at the same rate, but black kids are arrested for it so many more times. And, you know, I think like some of my friends and I talk about this, where like we got away with murder, you know, and we're just like, we wonder if we were not white kids, if we had gotten away with, you know, and it's just like, then you go to jail when you're like 16 or whatever. And, you know, all kids break the law. And I think that, I don't know why. I think it's at least equal. So I'm going to go ahead and do true.
Okay.
Yeah, I feel the same way, because like I feel like the minority students, in this case blacks, but I think it could extend to others maybe, would be more scared of the potential consequences.
Well, they didn't speculate as to why, and it would be speculation, but it's true. It's tough that white students are twice as likely to abuse anti-anxiety medications after being prescribed them as black students, which is, you know, in line. I like to point these things out because the common understanding is that black people are more likely to do everything bad. And so whenever we can point out that that is not true, I like to point it out.
Oh, my God. It's crazy. And I think that like not everyone has the experience that you get to have when you're a reporter. And that's what I did. And for 3 years, I went around and I talked to so many different kinds of people. And it's such a good exercise that almost no one really gets. I interviewed all these women who knew Martin Luther King Jr. in St. Augustine, Florida. It was actually so bad there. It's such a beautiful place, but it was so bad there that he came down for a whole summer and there was an assassination attempt on him there. And this one just like cute older black woman said to me, she was like, you know, she just was such a nice lady. And she was like, there's not a time that I'm in the library that I don't feel like someone's about to put their hand on my shoulder and say, you know, you can't be here. And that you're like, it's so unfair and there is so much suffering. And like, I hate when people minimize slavery and like the behemoth of our culture that it's just like, well, that's not now. I mean, it's like, I have seen so many people in positions of power say these arguments that you're just like, no, like that's not.
Absolutely.
Right.
It's So I don't know. It's like, it's still so, it's sad how far we still have to go. It's really, it's really hard.
Yep. Did you have one, Berto?
I do. Okay. In terms of political psychology, which admittedly is a limited field, but in terms of political psychology, motivation is viewed as a goal-oriented behavior driven by a need for power.
What? The worst question.
So, tough.
So listen.
Let's move on.
Listen,
tough.
Political motivation is viewed as a need
I don't know
for
what's
power.
In this field, you understand? Like, I just told you I don't even know this field exists.
This one you could intuit a little bit.
How do you think I feel? I don't know.
This one you
but
could
But it
intuit
could be, okay, so say it again.
Political motivation is viewed as a need for power.
Political motivation
is viewed as a need for power.
What kind of motivation? To get political power?
Political motivation. And so,
tough. Yeah. Sounds reasonable.
Motivation.
Yeah.
Sounds
tough.
Reasonable. Tough.
Okay. Tough. It's not just power. It's power, affiliation, intimacy, and achievement.
Great.
These are the
no, but
worst.
This is interesting.
All right. Well, that does it. It is interesting,
because,
but you understand,
we
like, we have no basis to answer that question.
I don't have any basis to answer most of these questions.
No, you
it's
totally
got,
have a basis.
No,
on
no,
all
no, no,
the
no,
questions
listen,
that
listen.
I have, you can absolutely base it on your own experience.
But we know
that detail,
and we know we can
but
project. Right?
You're asking us to know what's in a particular field. That's not what. If you said Bill Clinton said X, Y, or Z, but you're asking us about a field. I just told you I haven't even heard about.
But the field's analyzing reality, and the reality is that, yeah.
But I don't
actually,
even know that. You said it came out in the 1800s. It could be completely backwards for all I know.
Well, this was in 1996. But
you could have said, you know, I don't know.
No, but look,
I don't know
look,
how
look,
you would word
look,
that.
Look, like, a politician.
Get off that Wikipedia page. That's all I have to say.
A politician isn't only guided by power needs. That's my point.
Then say that or something.
Well,
but you're asking us in
I'm
a particular
saying, like,
field.
We could guess this, right? That motivation for a politician isn't just about power.
I could guess that.
Yeah, but that's what they concluded.
But I'm not. But I don't know what they would say.
But it's like when we ask, "What did this study conclude?" It's just.
But
based
that's
on
different
because
that's based on reality. You're talking about a field of study. I could say to you,
but why do you think they came up with those from observations?
Adler once said, "Blah blah 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 blah." And if whether or not it's reasonable or not, you have no idea if Adler said that because you don't study Adler.
But you don't have to because you're guessing what he would have perceived in reality.
All right. Well,
but
I
Adler
studied...
is a lots of people say lots of weird things
but
in
that's,
history.
That's
Umberto,
fine. Yeah.
I have studied gamification and making fun games, and there has to be some chance of winning, or else it's not fun. And
that's
you're making
right.
it so we have zero chance of winning.
If you have two people
that's
basically
true.
Looking at you, going like, "I
what?
Have no basis to answer this question,"
but
then you
the
should probably
thing.
Listen
I
to
don't
some feedback.
I don't know what a study would have revealed.
All right,
about,
fine. We demand that you. Like, dumb down your questions. That's what we're saying.
Just get off of that Wikipedia page.
Stop
and find
making us look so
Wikipedia
bad.
Page. No, you can make us look bad. I don't mind about that. But I'm just saying, even to the listeners.
No one can know how dumb I am.
I could agree that the first question is unresolvable if you don't know anything about, which I don't. And so I would have also gotten it wrong. I could see how the second question, if you haven't read the books, you're still guessing. I understand. But I picked this one on purpose.
No, no, the Freud one is way less obscure than
well,
what you're talking
you,
about.
Well, for you, I've never even heard of those two
but
books.
At least you have heard of Sigmund Freud, correct?
But not the books.
Yeah, no, not the books.
But this
but,
is
but
different.
Still, it's
this is guessing about whether or not...
A field I have not even heard
no, no,
of
but
before.
Whether or not in that field, whatever, these psychologists would have thought that motivation is
all
only right, based
just
on power.
Someone punched someone else.
Right? But you understand what I'm saying. I could look up an obscure field right now, like Adler. Adler,
it's not
and I could say Adler believed that the second born in a family is blank, and there's no, you don't have anything
but
to base
okay.
it on.
That's okay, but that's, we do questions like that.
I don't actually ask questions like that because those are very frustrating to answer because you're just like, I don't know. And through trial and error of making lots of tougher bluff questions, I've looked at your faces and realized what questions tend to go over well and which ones don't.
Well,
questions that involve taint go over really well with Paulette. So next time there's going to be a lot of taint related questions.
Oh my God. I'm on the job market, everyone. If anyone out there wants to hire me now that you've heard of my love of the word.
I think, my honest belief is that if I had asked only this question, your reaction would not have been that. Like, I think,
fine,
I
it was
think
the
you were
straw that broke
the
camel's
first
back.
Questions.
No, no,
so
the second one I was okay with. The Freud one I was okay with. No. I literally just this week bought 5 books by Freud, and one of them might have been even one of the ones that you mentioned. So yeah, it's right up my alley this week. So I wasn't bothered by the second one. The
I'm
second
bothered.
One's fine. Freud questions are fine. That's and to the listeners, many of them are interested in Freud history.
Oh, God, people are going to hear this?
Yeah, that's
oh,
right.
Oh, shit.
All right, well, that does it for another episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us, and please take care of yourself. Why? Because you deserve it. You know, someone actually emailed me and said that they thought that sign-off was really quite touching. I've always wondered, because one time I said to someone, I said, take care of yourself in an email or in verbal or something. And they said that it was insulting to them because they thought I was telling them to not reach out to me. It's like, hey, take care of yourself.
Hey, quit talking to me.
Yeah, I don't want to be here for you. Take care of yourself.
Go away.
But that's not what I mean by it. And then, so that's kind of why I followed up with because you deserve it. And then, I always wonder if people are going to take it well. But actually, someone said that they receive it well. What do you guys think? Is it a
just
good
say,
sign off?
I thought
you
were saying you've done bad things and you deserve to have to only take care of yourself.
You're listening to this podcast. You're obviously in prison.
So you got what you deserve.
Take care of yourself.
We assume all of you out there are just not doing well.
You deserve it.
So please stop whatever it is you're doing to hurt yourself. And be nice to yourself because you deserve it.
Because you deserve it.
Hey, you deserve it. Hey, buddy, you're doing great. Good job.
Yeah.